Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program begins with a scruffy little newspaper that lived two lives. Its first incarnation 50 years ago in May 1971. Its rebirth was on July 20th, 1979, 10 years to the day after Earth beings first walked on the moon. The newspaper was named from its inception the North Coast Times-Eagle. It was first off the press and spent its initial lifetime in Wheeler, Oregon. Its reincarnated life began in Cannon Beach and ended nearly 30 years later in Astoria. The editor and publisher of the original Times-Eagle was an orphan of French descent, a disaffected Air Force veteran of Vietnam named Robert Stanley Need. His journalistic purpose was to be a roaring mouse challenging the Philistine pachyderm press that he considered corrupt and crapulent. For five lean and stormy years, he published a feisty, rashly eccentric weekly newspaper patterned in style and design after the small crusading couriers of the frontier 19th century. Need, his name its own metaphor, engaged about 200 kindred and generally unpaid spirits to fight the good fight against journalistic imperialism, most of whom endured his Napoleonic editorship beyond despair and hunger. The original Eagle crashed after a ballistic half-decade of intense crusading journalism, always in debt and under fire from the coastal established order. I was the next to last news editor of that first incarnation, summoned at the Ark of Doom, so to speak. I resurrected the Times Eagle after it had been editorially languid for 3 years. Essentially because I thought its death was grossly premature, like a murdered child. I chopped wood, cleaned motel rooms, hauled garbage, and borrowed money from friends to print the first issue of The Born Again Bird on July 20th, 1979, and I was barely able to sustain its second lifetime for 27 and a half years, first in Cannon Beach and afterward in Astoria, keeping it afloat on dirty dishwater as a dish dog in various coastal eateries, also as a bartender, fry cook, and swamper in shoreside cafes and saloons, as a caretaker for mentally retarded folk, selling tickets at a movie house and a maritime museum. A journalist's life. The born-again bird flew on improvident wings the entire period of its second life, which ended in 2007, after 28 years out of the crypt. But its second death was not economics, but from computerization of print technology, and my own inept disinclination to conform to the electronic superhighway of infinite digital journalism and infotainment. The Times Eagle of dual lifetimes was a member of the poverty press, obsessed with a vision unaffected by commerce. It was descended from radical newspapers that blossomed briefly in the 1950s and 1960s, but its lineage threaded back to the prickly press that fostered the First Amendment, which denies government or anyone else the right to interfere with free expression, whether in speech or print. An imperative assumption of a democracy is that the free flow of information is essential. But of course, interference and manipulation of information is among the highest priorities of political authoritarianism. Without an independent press or broadcast media, such as KMUN and its sister station KBOO in Portland, journalism is hardly more than an artfully deceptive method of misleading the public, especially with the rise of blatantly right-wing radio and television. The independent media, which has few pretensions toward objectivity and fewer illusions about its probability, provides an insistent and vital forum that commercial megamedia generally eschews for the exchange, analysis, comprehending, and argument of issues, opinion, and thought are at the base of every culture and community. The born-again Times Eagle was resurrected from its grave, I wrote in its first manifesto, because First Amendment newspapers have become as rare as the nation's symbol, the bald eagle. The independent press has virtually disappeared into the huge corporations that control the country and probably the world. In this age of the great systems, devotion to any principle other than the status quo seems quaint and naive and faintly dangerous. But the enormous pressure of population and economics threaten the way we live. The great contradictions between freedom and property have finally reached us. Like everything else, the role of the press is in question. There should be no doubt. The press should have no special interest than the First Amendment. This is patently impossible when the press is controlled by corporations whose interests are often in conflict with the Constitution. The great renegade journalist A.J. Liebling once said, "The press was free only to those who owned one." And Robert Stanley Need answered his own question, should the Times Eagle exist? The answer, of course, is no, he wrote. The Times Eagle can cease publication when it has effectively established a communications forum among the coastal communities, its citizens, and those who love the Oregon coast from afar, that assures forever the proper use and maintenance of its lands and resources. When intelligence and love, consideration of others, and preservation of life-sustaining processes, rather than self-service, commercial greed, and the putrid essence of political manipulation, are the accepted and normal criteria of coastal life, then there is no need for the North Coast Times Eagle. And that was Robert Stanley Need. He wrote that on July 11th, 1974. Robert Stanley Need died in July 2004 at age 74. And now, Oregon's famously unofficial poet laureate, Walt Curtis, jubilated his 80th birthday, coincidental to Happy Yankee Doodle Independence Day, the 4th of July. 1941 was the year of his nativity, 165 years after the birth of liberty, justice, and poetry for all. Salmon Song and Malinoche author, Walt wrote the following eulogy to his youth for the July 1985 issue of the North Coast Times Eagle. My Mother in Hot Summer by Walt Curtis. The heat gets to her. It's the disease, multiple sclerosis. The nerves act funny, like a wilting flower. A fading rose, my wonderful mother, diminishes a day at a time. I watch her dragging around the house. She is so calm, intelligent, cheerful, yet she knows. Her hair is snow gray, and her feet are red and blotchy from poor circulation. When I help her cut her fingernails, her hand is cool, without strength. She is so serene. She manages such composure in a lonely house. My dad died of cancer 4 years ago and left her alone. It's just like my Aunt Emma said. Margaret's physical condition seems poorer, but her brains are as bright as ever. Mom heard that from her other sister, Aunt Sal. They talk on the phone all of the time. Aunt Emma and Uncle Ray visited her for a few days in June. He's got a plastic aorta and arteries into his groin, but he's really active with a strong handshake, stronger than mine. An aneurysm was discovered in his aorta. It was about ready to burst. An ineffectual doctor had been treating him for an ulcer. He decided to go to somebody else, and the good doctor sent him immediately into surgery. He's recovered, smokes cigarettes, and keeps busy all the time. Aunt Emma smokes also, drinks bourbon, and figures out things for him to do. Uncle Ray cleaned out the garage with the leaking roof. My father's mechanic tools are mainly spoiled by the rain and damp made rusty. The tools he earned a living with. It's shameful, but what the hell were we to do? None of his sons was a mechanic. Nobody wanted to be greedy after his death and sell them. So for sentimental reasons, they deteriorated. There are a million things to do around this place. It's only 3 acres, but impossible to take care of on a part-time basis. The goddamn blackberry vines have grown over the garage, up into the pear trees. I will have to use the right kind of herbicide in order to stop them. They are incredibly tenacious, rooting everywhere on the property. You can cut, chop, hack, and still they thrive. The yellow tansy ragweed has spread throughout the summer countryside. Its bright yellow top pops up everywhere. It's supposedly poisonous to livestock, but they generally eat around it. Swishing reddish-brown tails, the chestnut horses of our neighbors ignore it. Mom, as my dad did before her, allows the neighbors to pasture the horses in our field. No sense letting the hay go to waste. The goats next door ignore it. There is a brown and yellow worm, tiger striped, which eats some of the ragged flowery tops. Is this bug an ecological answer? Still, I see the damned yellow weed growing everywhere. I lop it off with a sickle or try to pull it up. The brittle stem breaks, leaving the basil leaves to revive next year. It should be dug up with a shovel, but who the hell is going to go to that trouble under the hot summer sun? Mopping sweat off my balding forehead. Not me. The fluffy-headed thistles are going to seed. I try to knock them down so their gray heads won't blow fluff on the wind. I feel heroic chopping at the weeds with a handsickle. Prince Valiant. I am losing, but some of the weeds go down before my swipes. For my mother, trapped in her castle. The weapon is rusty from standing too long in the damp garage. I know she appreciates the sporadic effort. There are grass seeds, burrs in my socks and tennis shoes. The natural Timothy grass, hay, holds its own pretty well, but stickery thistles, brambles, hawthorn, tansy, dandelions have pretty much overrun the property. It's a real battle. The years, time, and its vegetational allies are winning. The mice, the moles. There are a half dozen things to do every time I visit. Empty the garage, help cook dinner, water and weed the garden. Sometimes I thaw a can of lemonade, squeeze real lemons and limes to add to the store-bought mixture. Help my mother with a shaking hand, sip the lemonade, and swallow a vitamin pill. However, I enjoy visiting my teenage homestead. I relish the longevity of it and the ironies of time. Our human persistence against its slow, subtle, overwhelming force. I could never take my father's place. All I can do is help my mother a little. Come out once a week, take the garden hose, and water the rhododendrons, the robin's egg blue hydrangea, the climbing red rose is called Crimson Rambler, the garden. As I hold the green hose watching the cold, clear water spurt Oh, the shiny green leaves. I recall my dad used to do the same thing. Daily water every damn shrub, plant, and bush on the place, so the hot summer sun wouldn't burn them up. His calloused hands touched this same green plastic hose. Cold, clear, refreshing, Clackamas River water flowing out. As a joke, he would turn the spray on Mike, the dog, or suddenly zap the white geese, sending them honking, or Mike whimpering away out of range. The old man loved a good joke. At the end, he thought his coming demise was a bad one. This year, the zucchini in the garden are prolific. Mottled green marble, they are baseball bats, which will swell monstrously huge into football-sized objects. From beneath the golden blossom swells this thickening phallic vegetable. The stiff stems and angular leaves scrabble over the ground, securing territory. I pick them up and give them away, and still more grow. Our family always had a wonderful garden, planted and growing in the backyard. There is nothing as tasty as fresh, sun-ripened tomatoes, carrots, beets, or green onions pulled directly from the dirt, washed, and placed on the table for the evening meal. My first garden poem was Cabbages in the Garden. In 1975, I published the collection, The Sunflower and Other Earth Poems, which for me made a definitive statement about being alive. We belong with the carrots, the bunny rabbits, the sunflowers. We have a season, as they do. To ask for more than that is folly. I began to accept the notion that death is appropriate after a normal lifespan, probably even desirable, to go back into the earth. It is a terrible mistake to try to create a bionic immortality with technology. We will all end up to be zombies if we're not careful. The poems and this philosophy, as well as being derived intellectually from Zen, Alan Watts, Gary Snyder, etc., come from my family background. My dad always planted a garden. That was a common, ordinary cultural activity of Americans in the first half of the 20th century. I experienced it directly by hoeing, pulling weeds, spading the ground with a shovel, using animal fertilizer, watering the plants, and earthworm ribs that the shovel has cut into. The worm turns and one day will devour us. I remember seeing my younger brother Wayne in a photograph, about 4 years old, posing behind a gigantic cabbage, maybe weighing 60 pounds, which was grown in our home garden in Olympia, Washington. The cabbage was as large as he was. Does that explain why the cabbages in the early poem seem so anthropomorphic? There is the innuendo of cabbage patch children in the poem. Also, poor little bastards abandoned by their cruel mothers. I admit this year's garden is somewhat ravaged, without my dad working in it daily. My sister Nancy and I have tried with intermittent watering and weeding to salvage it. The neighbor's goats did a number on it, but the tomatoes look good. The cucumbers and zucchini are quite productive. It looks sprightly with marigolds and a row of red zinnias. The tradition has been maintained. That's what counts, the spirit which is put into a project, more so than the results. Human affairs are measured as much by concern, sincerity, and authenticity as they are by actual accomplishment. I wonder if the quality of life on Earth isn't diminishing daily as we approach the 21st century. I am certain that it is. Everywhere in the world, only an ecological ethos spreading with religious fervor and acting as an operational political force internationally will save us and planet Earth. Most of the larger mammals and the anthropologically diverse cultures of humanity are becoming extinct. It's a sad and terrible thought that this evolutionary organic complexity should die out in just a few generations. The cabbages are asking themselves the question, will we be exterminated along with the other plants and creatures in the coming nuclear holocaust? If humans filled the muzzles of the guns with earth and crap and buried the missile silos in compost, we might survive the coming decades in the Northern Hemisphere. Otherwise, no. We should shut down the nuclear power plants, which contaminate the biosphere with radioactive filth in every direction for succeeding generations. We must dismantle the weapons systems. The Trojan nuclear power plant, located 45 miles from Portland, near Mount St. Helens, on the Columbia River, is the second largest such plant in the United States. Many assume Oregon is an ecological paradise. The gigantic cooling tower looms in the pristine landscape like a clay burial jar, a death urn, accumulating and disseminating arcane poisons which have never existed before. When I first saw it, I was startled by its design and reminded of the long, melancholy immortality, urn burial, by Sir Thomas Brown. There it is, made manifest by modern technology, the eerie coffin shape of the future. And that was My Mother in Hot Summer, written in July 1985 by Walt Curtis, Oregon's unofficial poet laureate, whose birthday was July 4th. And now his first poem, Cabbages in the Garden. They are nine in number. Their outer leaves are of odd animals, rhinos, an armadillo's ears smashed flat, rooted solid. Their heads are little green suns or ugly crystal balls. Poor cabbage has no close neighbors except rhubarb with her red limbs and elephant's ears. The cabbage in my garden are so sad. They are like moons fallen out of sky. I want to cry, viewing them so forlorn and serious, worrying about coleslaw and sauerkraut. I promise never to eat them. Instead, I will send them to an orphanage in a big basket tied with Easter ribbons. Don't worry, my dear cabbage, my little darlings. I won't beat you. And that was from Rhymes for Alice Blue Light by Walt Curtis. And a couple more of his poems. The Sage. The sage, perched on a cliff, welcomes the abyss, clouds and emptiness, vast space, galaxies and stars. The sun is an atomic tunnel to the other side, nuclear inferno, blasted from the Big Bang. What a playing field, mountains and rivers without end. Only it isn't an explosion, which nurtures life and thought, mist on the face, from waterfalls and endless billowing clouds wash over from the pure land. Green moss, lichens, and wild birds sing into being music from afar. Ancient pine trees with gnarled fingers might well be wise old men and cronies in silken garb. Wisdom needn't bow to a nuclear blast. World's end. Worlds are reborn. The sage knows there is no beginning nor end. Everything comes from nothing and returns. Mist on his face, craggy wind blowing through garments. The sage knows time is an illusion. Eternity is percolating in his cells right now. The softest thing, water, breaks down granite peaks and rivers return gently from the sea, all entropy. Picking tears. I toss the pears on the quilt, cushioning the fall. What an easy way to get them off the lifting limbs, rather than handing them one by one to my invisible helper on the ground. Pendulous, bell-like fruit, aren't fresh pears peerless, paired with a knife and put onto a compote? My hands caress their cool, green globe-like forms, green breasts with a rosy flush and wooden stems. Bright yellow and sweet in a week or so, yellow jackets would gouge their fragrant skins if left upon the waxen tree, or they would fall with a thud and bruise themselves. Seeking delicious life-saving winter sap, and fierce bees become sadists, and mind, they'd sting mine if I didn't leave them alone with the leafy lady. Ever since reading the first pornographic novels, wherein women's breasts are compared to pears, I have imagined it the other way around. The woman in the wood bends forward, her branches and whispers, "Pick me." My clumsy, eager fingers glom onto her, and boxes fill with bosomy beauty, boxes of breasts like hard green bells. Ding dong, I sing along as I pick pears, humming with the bees. The City of Sorrows, a fable. There is a city in the west, far from Constantinople, with its fabled spires and golden minarets, scent of cinnamon. The wind sounds like hush, whispering in the wintry firs all summer long. Nothing is obvious about the sorrow the people feel. They find it quite unreal enough as so much as the loss of love. White doves die daily, silken feathers spattered with red, and no one is able to express the dread he feels when a little shower downpours on a child's head. The child cries and runs to mommy. The fountains trickle like leaky faucets. The butterfly's wings wave bye-bye. Grandmother's wearing gewgaws, eyes go gaga at moist, icky slugs creeping on the walk. No one knows exactly how to express it, but each feels it in his bones like rheumatism when sorrowful fog rolls up the somber valley like wagon loads of cloud or milk, fog like a cold hand on the back of your neck. Yes, it rains every day in the City of Sorrows, and the windows of the houses are streaked with what appears to be tears at second glance. And the soft rain. Something is sinuous about the soft rain and sad, like a string of, not pearls, but hot tears, plucked from the ocean depths, pried from the oysters of your eyes. I, the poor lover, made you cry every time it rains like this. I realize that I am the deep sea diver who opened your eyes, a flood of salty visions, those signals of your SOS. Such jeweled distress do not reach me at 40 fathoms deep. No, only the soft drops of rain on my face when I rise to the surface allow me to recall the look, the place, a lover's disgrace. Seated by flakes of grit, your body remains on the bottom of life's ocean. Not murine, no lotion soothes the ache. Touching my face, the soft rain is like the sobbing of a seashell pressed to my ear and dripping hair. And those poems were by Walt Curtis, Oregon's longtime unofficial poet laureate. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is program engineer. Intro piano by Keith Jarrett. My younger brother, a former college prof, thinks half of humanity is stupid. His low opinion seems borne out by the plethora of anti-vaxxers in the USA, even as COVID is once more on the attack with a virulent Delta variant. What particularly perplexes me are the right-wing politicians who urge the anti-vax virus deniers on as if they are not jeopardizing their own political aspirations by aiding and abetting killing off their voters. Whichever half of humanity you lay claim to, the plague is resurgent, So be intelligent and compassionately self-protective. Vaccinate and isolate. The germ war is not over, and wishing does not make it so.